This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, President Obama's State of the Union address falls flat. Politicians in West Virginia are telling people the water is safe, but most aren't drinking it themselves. And black students at the University of Michigan demand more diversity on campus.
But first, it's hard to find anyone who's genuinely excited about President Obama's State of the Union address. That certainly goes for Kevin Alexander Gray, the Columbia, South Carolina activist and author of the book Waiting for Lightning to Strike, The Fundamentals of Black Politics. Gray says State of the Union speeches should outline a path to a brighter national future, but Obama's message was empty of vision.
The only thing memorable about the State of the Union is how unmemorable it is. I don't see anything that was radical or new, thought-provoking, that challenges the nation to do something significant, that makes people want to participate in the process of changing the society that we're living in, that's becoming more poor, that the wealth disparities are growing and the gap is growing. If people were looking to hear it in the State of the Union speech, they were just looking for a mirage. The idea that you have so many people that are chronically unemployed, so many black people that are chronically unemployed, and you simply can't take up something like a job training bill. I was involved in the Comprehensive Employment and Training Act programs of the 70s and 80s and Job Partnership Training Act. It was CETA and JPTA, where you train people to work in the public sector, in the private sector. You gave them transportation assistance. You gave them training. You gave them child care assistance. You made them ready for work. He could have talked about that. If the president wants to go into New Yorker and talk about marijuana not being any worse than alcohol, then he could have talked about amnesty for nonviolent drug offenders, almost like what Carter did with the Vietnam War desertees or the ones that fled to Canada. You could talk about not raiding all those places that you're raiding in California that are selling marijuana. You could do that. But the idea that 2 years in to your second term, that you think you're going to try to do something, you're going to go around Congress, you're going to pass executive orders, and then you're going to talk about the special problems of young men of color because you can't even bring yourself to say the word black. One of them other words he couldn't say. He couldn't say black, poverty, or poor for 5 years. And now because he's going to see the Pope, he's going to talk about wealth inequity, like the Pope and the Catholic Church is going to really turn over any of their money. You know, it's all becoming just a joke. And the joke is on the people, and the people need to stand up because it's not about Obama and what he represents. He represents a corporate America. He represents the empire. You know, he wants to talk about student loans. Well, why not talk about free public education? There are some things that can be done, and there are some things that can be said that he can say, but he's not going to say them. And to talk about educational reform and standardized tests, when that's all that Arne Duncan, Barack Obama, charter school, elite movement is about, and about making school, privatizing school and putting it on Wall Street and monetizing it, people being had. Now, 2 years is all we have to go in this new face of American democracy. But it's not going to get any better before it gets worse. And people need to start considering what they need to do on the local level to organize against it. How do you organize against the folk on the local level, Democrats and Republicans, and really put some people in office, if that's how we're going to do this, to really change things? What kinds of pressure can you put on government? What kind of lawsuits can you file? When do you need to be marching on people's offices? When do you need to do the same kinds of boycotts and challenges that we did during the last successful big movement, the anti-apartheid movement? How do we take on those companies like SodaStream or Caterpillar or Bank of America or Citigroup? How do we take them on and make them feel some consequence for exploiting people? How do we take on the politicians that is all just about them making money, them passing on that wealth and that power to their kids, to where we're coming up on an election and all anybody can talk about are the Bushes and the Clintons? Just sad.
If corporate money has the electoral system locked up and paralyzed, then mass grassroots activity is the only alternative.
I mean, people have a think that having things is what progress is about. And so, you know, a lot of people support these corporations because they support the concept of having things. So some of this stuff is consciousness and the idea that the more things you have, the more exploitation that goes along with it. And so you have to consider a different way of life. That's something hard for people to conceptualize, the idea of cooperation as opposed to competition, the idea of cooperatives as opposed to these so-called privileged capitalist entities that are protected by government. You know, that's a whole different mindset for people to come to grips with. And I think that's where we're at in society. If we don't figure something out, it's not going to last too much longer beyond our kids or our grandkids. And, you know, for you and I, we're in our 50s, but it can't sustain itself. Something has to change. Now, what Obama said that interested me a bit was this idea of being on permanent war footing. And what he could have added to it was, so let's talk about a peace dividend. He could have talked about, instead of pimping that young soldier, he could have talked about the $1.5 billion per tour that we spend on these soldiers and translating that money into some of those same kinds of programs I mentioned earlier in the conversation, JPTA and infrastructure repair and educating kids so they don't have a debt and building affordable housing and talking about a living wage instead of a livable wage and just increasing the minimum wage. Those are not only concrete things, but those are concepts that we need to talk about. In the drug war, amnesty for nonviolent drug offenders, job training for the chronically unemployed, housing support for those that were hit by the subprime debacle, which has never been solved, ending endless wars and using that peace dividend to fund free public education, using some of that money to help the public school system instead of creating an elite educational system.
Which would, of course, require a reversal of Obama's policies.
Absolutely. But which gets back to the people understanding what is the long-term consequences of many of these policies, to include the Affordability Care Act. I mean, that's basically just a corporate giveaway. What does that do for the move for universal health care in this country? We need to pick that banner back up instead of just saying, okay, we'll fight the Medicare expansion fight on the local level, which is what some of us are doing. We're doing it just because it seems like a way at least to get some people covered. But, you know, we've got to pick up the banner of universal health care. So it's about the people moving. I had said on one program it was about looking at things bottom up instead of top down, but that still is looking up at a top. We have to figure out a way to make things a little more egalitarian and spreading things out. And we got to not be afraid to talk about socialism as opposed to capitalism and what we demand of this government. And we can't be afraid or be cowed by neoliberals or neoconservatives in fighting that fight.
And that means we're going to have to fight our way through a new crop of black politicians as well.
Well, I believe in calling people out. I don't believe in being polite about it. It's time for being polite. Is over. That's not saying, because we're on the radio, that's not saying violence, because that's who they are. We're responding in a positive way to all the negatives that they bring, all this warlike bullying mentality. America is the big bully. We're the opposite of that. But we've got to challenge those folk who are operating for the interest of the corporations and the money people, and they're not operating in the interest of the people. Those folk like Cory Booker, those folk like Kasim Reed, those folk like Barack Obama, like Rahm Emanuel, like Hillary Clinton. We got to take that on.
instead of debating about who the black folks around Hillary Clinton are going to be.
Yeah, and then Boosie, I mean, it's all this cult of personality, cult of celebrity, the politician of celebrity, the politician as in so-called new royalty. It's all this classism and people aspiring for a place in this classist, elitist structure instead of fighting for the destruction of that structure. We are here to challenge that. That was the message of Rest in Peace Pete Seeger. That was the message of Mandela. The tribe, the people, not being about one person trying to be the hero or the leader or the monarch or the messiah of us all.
That was Kevin Alexander Gray in Columbia, South Carolina.
Lynn Paramore is a senior editor at Alternet, the online news magazine. She authored an article titled State of the Union, Obama's Underwhelming Plan to Tackle Inequality. President Obama spent more than a month building up to his speech last Tuesday on the theme of fighting economic disparities. But Lynn Paramore says the president's message didn't measure up.
Well, no. In fact, I was just thinking about this today when it was announced that several CEOs from Boeing and Apple and Walmart are headed to the White House to talk to President Obama regarding something he brought up in the State of the Union address, which was the long-term unemployment problem that America is having. And President Obama, in his speech, called upon business leaders to do something about it, to please don't discriminate against the long-term unemployed. And I just wonder if he's going to ask pretty please with sugar on top to these corporate CEOs, many of whom are known for their abuses of workers. Boeing has been strong-arming unions, threatening workers. Apple has been sitting on a mountain of cash and paying peanuts to its retail workers. Are these really the people that the president is going to turn to when we have a national emergency? I just really scratch my head when I read about this.
Yes, and he made what he called a major job speech at Amazon, of all places.
Of all places. I mean, look, let's get serious here. Since about the 1980s, major corporations have really been waging a war against American workers. They have been laying off workers, refusing to retrain them. Again, union bashing has been commonplace. Horrible contracts, terrible pay, wage theft. I mean, the list goes on. And it just seems like an insult to the Americans who are suffering through no fault of their own. They've lost their jobs mostly as a result of a Wall Street-driven financial crisis, to turn to some of the very perpetrators of this national problem. I mean, really, if we go back to the New Deal, to Roosevelt's administration, we know how to respond to a problem like this. And we know that the federal government needs to use the full force of its power to address long-term unemployment. And Obama really has not made that a priority at all. And I just think the idea that the CEO of Boeing is going to offer to solve the long-term unemployment crisis is a joke, frankly.
I think back in the 80s, they called that jawboning. During his 2008 campaign, he promised that he'd seek a $9.50 minimum wage by 2011. He didn't do anything about that. He promised he would push for card check, a bill that unions were very keen to get, but he didn't do much about that either. And now he says that he'll, by executive order, institute a $10.10 minimum wage for federally contracted workers, but he didn't say that's only for new hires.
Exactly. So it's for a relatively small group of workers. I mean, I guess it's better than absolutely nothing, but not too much better. $10.10 is pretty paltry. There's even a Republican out in California, a libertarian, Ron Unz, who has been calling for a $12 minimum wage. So it's disappointing to see the president starting out with the most meager possible proposal. You know, let's hear about $15 an hour, and let's hear about workers beyond, you know, new federal contract hires. It's a little too little, and it's a little too late, in my opinion.
Even bourgeois economists agree that NAFTA put a downward push on unionization and on worker compensation in the United States. Now the president is trying to fast-track a Trans-Pacific Partnership, a secret treaty that people have called NAFTA on steroids. He only made an oblique reference to that in his State of the Union address.
That's exactly right. And the only thing appropriate for him to have said about it in the State of the Union address would be that he was going to back off of it because the details that have been coming out, at least a little bit in the mainstream press, although I think most Americans don't really understand what's going on here, it's absolutely awful. And we have learned this lesson before. I mean, really, if you look at Obama's speech, he is still stuck in a neoliberal economic paradigm that has been quite destructive for most ordinary, hardworking Americans. And it's just a shame that here we are in the sixth year of his presidency, years after a major financial crisis, and the lesson still hasn't been learned that this economic paradigm is flawed. It pits corporations against workers, and it really has wreaked havoc on the lives of millions and millions of people. And it's just a shame that the president has backed this absolutely awful trade agreement. It's a disgrace.
You write that we didn't hear about bringing justice to criminal bankers who prey on hardworking Americans. How can we talk about making a dent in the economic inequality gap if bankers are too big to jail?
That's exactly right. The two-tiered justice system that we have in the United States right now is something that is really debilitating to the national psyche. You know, it really goes deep. It plants a seed of distrust in our institutions that's really destructive of democracy. I mean, I think seeing bankers walk off scot-free when they've done things 1,000 times worse than what most people sitting in America's prisons have done is really shocking, and it's damaging to the spirit of our country. You cannot open a newspaper without reading about some major abuse by a big bank, whether it be money laundering or bribery or improper foreclosures or some kind of trading fraud. It's rampant. It hasn't gotten any better. J.P. Morgan is just racking up abuse after abuse after abuse. They continue to make profits. And for them, the little fines that they get slapped on them are simply the cost of doing business. And what's really scary is that other industries are sort of taking a cue from the banking industry and saying, hey, you know, they're allowed to get away with murder, and they're not going to be prosecuted if they get too big. Why don't we follow the same model? So, you know, you're going to get pharmaceutical companies, et cetera, having the mindset that they can cheat and abuse and harm American citizens and not only get away with it but make a hefty profit in the process. And this is just unacceptable. And if Obama really wanted to heal the psyche of the nation and really address inequality, he would get to the inequality in our justice system.
If Republicans have nothing to offer but austerity and a Democratic administration little more, then it appears that the rulers of America really have nothing to offer.
That is how it feels. And, you know, my home state, I live in New York now, but my home state of North Carolina is in bad shape right now. And one of the reasons it's in bad shape, obviously they have got Republicans who are completely out of control and lunatics. They've got Tea Partiers on steroids down there. But another problem has been a Democratic Party that has failed the ordinary people in the state. I was at the National Democratic Convention in Charlotte the last time, and boy, it was there in the Bank of America Stadium. You could see stretched limousines, you know, as far as the eye could see, skyboxes filled with millionaires. And ordinary people in North Carolina did not like that display. My grandfather was a tobacco farmer, and he was a pretty conservative guy by temperament. But I'll tell you, he did not trust bankers. He did not trust suits. He did not trust people from Wall Street. And so people like that in the state who see the Democrats seemingly siding with the wealthy and siding with Wall Street, it makes them think that they really don't have a choice. And I think, fortunately, in North Carolina right now, you're seeing a grassroots populist movement rise up, this Moral Monday protest that has been led by the Reverend Barber, and that's a positive sign because the people have just gotten so fed up. They're saying, we're going to have to take things into our own hands. We cannot rely on either party, really, to help us out of this.
Lynn Paramore of AlterNet. Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon doesn't believe the president is serious about helping working people. Dixon asked the question, do Democrats and President Obama really want to raise the minimum wage?
President Obama and National Democratic Party spokespeople now agree that the minimum wage ought to be raised, and the mighty executive pen of the White House will soon force federal contractors to pay workers at least $10.10 an hour. Though this only applies to federal contractors and can be rolled back if Republicans win the White House in 2016, it is better than a sharp stick in the eye. It's also something the president could have done 5 years ago during his first hours in office. Back in 2007 and 2008, when President Obama was candidate Obama, he campaigned on a promise to put legislation through Congress to raise the minimum wage and to reform labor law so as to make it easier for workers to organize unions and to fight for their rights on the job. Both these cynical promises were immediately forgotten when Barack Obama assumed the presidency, and during the 2 years, his party held a thumping majority in the House with a narrow one in the Senate. The administration has never mentioned easing the restrictions on union organizing again, but once in a while, when their poll numbers get low enough, and as long as Republicans are safely in control of the House of Representatives, they dust off their rhetoric on the minimum wage. This is one of those times. To tell the truth, $10.10 an hour is not much. It's such a low floor that it probably can pass the House if Republican leaders ever allow a floor vote on it. But it's far from a wage that will lift anybody out of poverty. The elite bipartisan consensus, that's the president and his spokespeople, along with Republicans, agree that the solution is not so much raising the wage for what people already do as training for what will make them fit for better jobs. But that's a joke as well. The U.S. economy isn't producing better jobs. Starbucks is full of baristas with master's degrees, and most college teachers are now adjuncts, which means their advanced degrees enable them to work for poverty wages with few or no benefits. PhD incomes have fallen off a cliff in the last 10 years as colleges and universities reorganize themselves to more resemble the corporations who rule our society. Early in his presidency, the same Barack Obama proposed recalculating Social Security benefits so as to lower them. And late last year, he signed off on the reductions in unemployment compensation that he now wants immoral Republicans to take all the blame for. It's not hard to see that Democrats only take up the cause of the minimum wage when Republicans are in office to reinforce their fake brand as champions of the oppressed. When Democrats are in power, and raising that wage is a sure and easy thing, their attention drifts somewhere else. But once Republicans get the House or the Senate, they talk about passing a jobs bill, about universal pre-K, and about raising the minimum wage, more to embarrass their Republican partners than with a view towards actually accomplishing any of these things. They are all branding slogans, blatant and shallow hypocrisy. But so far, they have worked to reinforce the Democrats' brand as the party of the oppressed.
Black Agenda Report Managing Editor Bruce Dixon in Atlanta. Mumia Abu-Jamal, the nation's best-known political prisoner, is frankly flabbergasted at global levels of economic inequality. Mumia has this commentary.
Several days ago, a press report surfaced that was among the most outstanding I've ever seen. The headline bore a curious equation. 85 equals 3.5 billion. At first, it made no sense until I read the body of the article. It explained 85 people had wealth and assets equal to 3.5 billion people the world over. I had to reread it. 85 individuals had personal wealth equal to 3.5 billion people, or half the world. Isn't that amazing? Isn't that unbelievable? Isn't that astonishing? If ever we doubted how unequally wealth is distributed in the world, along comes this fact. If the Occupy movement hadn't been beaten back into the shadows, their remarkable call, "We are the 99%," or "Down with the 1%, would have to be revisited. For instead of 1%, it'd be 0.01%. 85 people, maybe 1,000th. Rome, infamous for its rich and corrupt Senate, never saw such inequality as this. Marx, for all of his acumen, never saw this coming. This vast wealth is especially obscene in an era of austerity, when budgets are cut, schools are closed, and prisons experience population booms. The politicians who serve this tiny, wealthy class cut more and more as Congress fills its own ranks with more and more millionaires. They are those who scream no new taxes on the wealthiest people in the world.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's commentaries are produced by Prison Radio.
The lives of 300,000 people in West Virginia's capital city, Charleston, were thrown into turmoil when 10,000 gallons of what was called a little-known chemical contaminated the city's water supply. We spoke with Russell Mokerber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter, who lives in West Virginia. Mokerber says the powers that be are now claiming that the water crisis is over, but virtually nobody believes that, including the political leaders themselves.
They've been told by both the water company and the state that the water is now safe to drink at an artificial limit, they said, at 1 part per million for this chemical that spilled. But a couple days after they said that, they told pregnant women not to drink it. And then a couple days after that, it was reported that this chemical that spilled wasn't the only chemical, that there was another chemical and other chemicals that had also spilled. Because of the culture of deregulation in West Virginia, we know very little about these chemicals. And because of the culture of deregulation in the United States, there was a report yesterday that formaldehyde was found in one of the tests being done. And even though the 300,000 people whose drinking water was affected are being told that it's safe to drink, go ahead and drink it, almost every state legislator, when asked, say they're not drinking it, they're not letting their kids drink it. And almost everybody in the know in West Virginia is refusing to drink it. One of the state legislatures took a shower because the do not use prohibition was lifted. So one of the state legislators took a shower, got her eye infected from the water, ended up with a life-threatening infection in the hospital and was treated by rounds of antibiotics to get her out of it. So there's a crisis of confidence in the corporate elite. But interestingly, these are the kinds of things that happen to people throughout the coal country, throughout the coal area of West Virginia. Their water turns black. They can't drink the water. There's nasty smells coming out. Now, though, in the state capitol, where all these PR execs and white-collar criminal defense lawyers and people who defend the coal industry live, they're now being directly affected by it. Ken Wood, the Charleston Gazette, made this point yesterday. And he thinks that maybe because of this direct impact on the power structure in West Virginia, that it might begin to change the corporate culture of deregulation and tilt it back towards some kind of fair balance.
Well, that leads us to a very, very simple question. If none of the state legislators are drinking the water because they're afraid, or why don't they do something about it to the extent that state legislatures can do anything about this?
Well, there is now a stampede because of the public uproar to do something about it. And political people, right-wing radio hosts, Republicans, corporate Democrats, which is most of them in West Virginia, who 2 weeks ago would have started screaming about the war on coal and overregulation and jackbooted EPA officials, all of a sudden are saying, well, yeah, let's pass this bill that would regulate above ground tanks. Regulation this week has become a good word. And the Senate, for example, passed Bill 373, which would regulate above ground tanks, and it was unanimous. Had that bill made it to the Senate floor before the spill, it would have been defeated unanimously. So the uproar is forcing the state legislators to move quickly, and they're doing that. But the question is, for the political elite, how long will this last? And my prediction is not long. So we have an election, for example, coming up. And let's take the 2nd Congressional District, where Charleston is. It's an open seat. Congresswoman Capito, who held it, is running for the U.S. Senate to take Rockefeller's seat, Senator Rockefeller's seat, who's retiring. And here's the lay of the land. The Democrat who will get the nomination is a guy named Nick Casey. He's a corporate Democrat, and we reported last week that he took $12,000 in one day from executives of the largest fracking company in the region. Fracking, of course, is hydraulic fracturing, refers to the way they're getting natural gas from the Appalachian Basin, and all kinds of questions raised about safety, impact on drinking water supplies, and so forth. And so there's Casey, corporate Democrat, and he's, as a result, mouthing the fracking industry's line about, you know, we have to do this, and there are adequate safeguards in place, and so forth. The Republican is a guy named Alex Mooney. He's going to get the nomination, backed by the Koch brothers and supported by Grover Norquist. So you have two corporate candidates. You do have a third candidate who's interesting, former CBS newsman Ed Rabel, running as an independent, getting signatures to get on the ballot as an independent. He's the only one challenging the corporate state in West Virginia. So it's going to be a three-way race, 60,000 votes, wins it, and we shall see whether the political climate has changed such that an independent, a truly independent voice can upend the political powers in West Virginia in the 2nd Congressional District. That will be a litmus test on whether we can translate the anger of the people into true political change. The other thing that's happening here is that along with Ed Rabel, a group of independents is running for a number of House legislative seats. And the great thing about the House legislative seats in West Virginia is you can win them with about 3,000 votes. So, you know, it's about a 50-50 split in the lower House of Delegates here. And the independents think they can grab a couple of those seats and hold the balance of power. So it's worth watching nationally about the pushback against the corporate Republicans and the corporate Democrats with a sort of like a surge of independents from the left here in West Virginia.
So is there the potential that this water crisis caused by the spillage of 10,000 gallons of chemicals into a waterway could spill over into a debate about fracking, which affects, of course, water tables?
Well, absolutely. It's happening already, primarily because of the aggressiveness of the fracking industry to dump money into the hands of West Virginia's politicians, and because the way both the Democrats and the Republicans take that money and then mouth the line of both the coal industry, the chemical industry, and the fracking industry, which control the state. So the question becomes, is this anger? We're not seeing people go into the streets. And when the state brought in the National Guard, they didn't bring in the National Guard just to deliver, you know, bottled water to the people. They were very concerned about social unrest in Charleston in the area. And luckily there was none, but it's a very tense situation, because not everyone can afford to leave the area to get a shower. Many people of means are leaving the Charleston area, going to Morgantown, places east and west, to be with relatives, to, you know, rent from hotel rooms or other places so they can get clean water. But not everyone can afford that, and people who can't afford it are being forced to use the water that's available, which apparently is still contaminated.
Regarding fracking, it's not just local politicians on the take everywhere, not just in West Virginia from the fracking industry, but the White House has been turned into, under President Obama, an international PR house for fracking.
And we saw that again in the State of the Union. So obviously we don't believe that everything should be on the table, which is President Obama's policy. We would take nuclear off the table and fracking off the table and coal off the table and move towards a renewable solar energy economy. And luckily, West Virginia is home to one of the largest solar energy companies in the country, Mountain View Solar. And we are lucky to have them here, and many young people are very excited about working for them and transforming the state from a fossil fuel state to a solar energy state. So that's the hope of the future of young people here in West Virginia, that will keep them here, that will bring them here, and hopefully lead to a cleaner future for the people of this state.
One of the things that was really shocking initially to me in reading about this crisis when it first developed was news media reports describing the chemical involved as a little-known chemical. How can chemicals that are stored next to waterways be little-known?
Well, this has to do with the failure of regulation. We should not be allowing these chemicals to be used without knowing about them. One of the things we're lucky for having here in West Virginia is Ken Ward, who's the investigative reporter for the Charleston Gazette. And one of the things that Ken pointed out was that while even though there is a material safety data sheet for all of these chemicals, when you look down on the sheet, which he's posted on their website, when you look down on their sheet, it lists what are the carcinogenic effects of this chemical, not known. What are these other effects, not known. So even though there is this, technically they've complied with the law and put out the safety sheet, it's just the testing wasn't done on it, so we don't know what the effects are going to be. Now, if we don't know what the effects are going to be, then obviously the prudent thing to do is to not to drink the water and not to bathe in the water, which creates a crisis for 300,000 people. What are they going to do? And so that's where we're at right now. You have some public health officials putting out the word that it's okay to drink the water and to bathe in it. But the people in the know, the legislators, the lawyers, the doctors in Charleston, when you press them and ask them, are you drinking the water? Are you letting your family drink the water? They say no, because we don't know.
Russell Mokeber, editor of the Corporate Crime Reporter.
Black students at the University of Michigan have set a deadline for the administration to address their 7 demands for more diversity on the campus. Robert Greenfield IV is a member of the Black Student Union and an activist with the newly formed organization Bend Black at University of Michigan, BBUM. Greenfield told Solomon Cummingsong, host of Your World News, that the university is deliberately marginalizing students of color.
There's a lack of validation to diversity at this campus. We have decreasing marginalized groups like blacks, like Native Americans, and note that the university is on Native American land. It's on a land grant. So, you know, when you talk about that in particular, you have a civil duty outside of you being a public institution to those students, you know, and I think they only make up, I think it's less than 0.1% of the university. And I know there are more Native Americans within the state of Michigan that would love to go to the University of Michigan. So I think really for the university, it's taking a step back from the official statements and the claims and really putting action behind it. And that's something that we stressed in the meeting, is that, you know, when we go about these processes, we want it in writing. We want it something that you have to look back and you have to say, well, we did say that. And they even do that now with documents from the Black Action Movements. So it's really evading a lack of action and making sure that there's accountability in providing diversity, because it's something that doesn't naturally culminate within the United States. You know, unfortunately, you do have to have an artificial hand to make sure that people from marginalized societies have an equal amount of opportunity as their white counterparts. So, you know, it's something that they're definitely going to have to step up and do, and I'm hoping they do in the upcoming meetings.
Can you tell us about how the black population, black student population, undergraduate student population has been declining in recent years, and also why is the university saying that it can't legally enroll, you know, a certain amount of black students?
Yeah, and that's something very interesting. So doing a lot of this enrollment data, and this is data collected from the University of Michigan, so if anyone goes against it, that's the data that they were comfortable putting out. The black campus community has been decreasing since 1992. And it's a lie, you know, if anyone says that it's because Proposal 2, Black Affirmative Action, and that decreased enrollment rates. In fact, within the whole state of Michigan, Black enrollment rates have been increasing, even with the 2006 implementation of that state legislation. And it's interesting to see that, you know, both University of Michigan and Michigan State, their trends have been opposite of what the state trend is in increasing enrollment. So when you see certain things like that, you have to disassociate the effects of Prop 2 and really, you know, label it on a, you know, a conscious effort to decrease Black enrollment at the university. I mean, there's really nothing outside of that. And then, you know, if you want to look for supporting data outside that say there are more international students than in-state Black, Hispanic, and Native Americans combined here. So, you know, then you're looking at, well, this is an investment move when you start educationally seeking out those who, you know, live outside the United States, just given that they're going to have to pay for visas, they're going to have to pay out-of-state tuition, and that creates a counterbalance with this financial transition that the university is making from a public institution to a private institution. So it's really evading the civil duty that it has to its student residents, and very much so the Black community within that group that's extremely concerning.
And Prop 2, which is Proposition 2 in the state of Michigan, that's the negation of affirmative action within that state?
Yes, yes. And I think that deals with the qualifications that you brought up. Is there's some misinformation that in order to enroll more Blacks or in order to enroll more minorities, less Asians, because I think they've come to a point in which, you know, in higher institutes of education, they've assimilated and are starting to assimilate to the white majority in some respects, that you can't do it because they're not qualified. And that's to assume that all people who are currently enrolled that are Black or Latino or Native American are the only ones qualified to be in college when, you know, it's always been illegal to, in whole or in part, employ or recruit somebody who is less qualified than others based off of race and gender. And I think that's Title VII in the Civil Rights Act, which predated Prop 2 by decades, and Executive Order 11246. And so these are, you know, laws that have been instituted that have always made it illegal for those less qualified to be admitted over those who are more qualified just based off their race. And I think that's a huge, huge, huge misunderstanding, both with Black students and white students, that you can only enroll more Blacks because they need some type of crutch to get in.
That was Robert Greenfield IV of the Black Student Union at the University of Michigan.
A new documentary is hitting movie theaters across the country. It's the story of Anita Hill, the young woman lawyer who charged Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas with sexual harassment during his confirmation hearings in 1991. Dr. Donald Smith remembers the events well. Smith is a founding member of the National Alliance of Black School Educators and a professor emeritus of education at New York City's Baruch College. Today, Justice Thomas ranks among the most unpopular people among Black Americans. But Dr. Smith reminds us that there was a time when many Blacks were eager to give Clarence Thomas a pass.
Most Black organizations supported him, and a lot of Black people didn't know who he was. I had been aware of Thomas long before his nomination. He used to be the chair of the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and he had no record of investigating and assisting Black people and Black organizations that were applying for assistance. He had no record of doing that. So I knew who Clarence Thomas was at the time that George Bush nominated him for Justice of the Supreme Court. I think many people did not know who he was. And certainly he was nobody who should have filled the shoes of Thurgood Marshall, the distinguished first Black member of the Supreme Court. But nonetheless, during his hearings, the testimony of a few people, one of them, Anita Hill, of how he had mistreated her when she worked under him, and she was herself an attorney of considerable information and skill. And not only had he not treated her properly, but she implied that he'd come on to her sexually, and she wanted no parts of him, if you'll excuse the expression. And unfortunately, many people did not support Anita Hill. It's still to this day difficult to understand why Clarence Thomas, who had no record of being of assistance to black people, would have been supported by so many, including Maya Angelou, yes, who said, give the brother a chance. Well, she was out of her territory. She really didn't know who he was and what he had not done for black folks, but she could have assumed that if President George Bush was appointing him to the Supreme Court, he was being appointed there because they knew that he would be a lackey who would support Supreme Court decisions against people of color. That should have been very clear, but it was not.
And in fact, he had quite a record if they had only researched it. But instead, they chose to give him a pass, not just a chance, but a pass.
Absolutely, a pass. Yes, that's right. Yeah, Maya Angelou said give him a chance. Well, a lot of black people gave him a pass.
And those included the National Alliance of Black School Educators, the group that
helped and the NAACP, right. Many organizations, black organizations, supported him. He has taken no positions in behalf of people of color, in behalf of people who are economically deprived. In fact, he has been in opposition to our people. It's going to be interesting how many of our people will take the time to see this new video that's coming out about Anita Hill and her struggle. Anita Hill was condemned by many black people as a black woman who was trying to hold a black man back. It's just unfortunate that we don't, even to this day, many of us and some who have college degrees, PhDs, don't take the time to learn who the people are who are supposed to be helping us. And we make assumptions that are not correct. And those were the assumptions about Clarence Thomas, that he would be somebody who would be worthy of following Thurgood Marshall as a Supreme Court justice, but he's been just the opposite of the great Thurgood.
Dr. Donald Smith, speaking from New York.
Clarence Moses L. has been in a Colorado prison since 1987. After his conviction for a rape he says he did not commit. In 1996, Clarence Moses L. hooked up with Barry Scheck's Innocent Project and raised $1,000 from fellow inmates to prove that the evidence showed that he was not guilty. But the Denver police has tossed out the evidence in a dumpster. Moses L. has been seeking a new trial ever since. His cause has been taken up by the People's Power Assemblies. Spokesman Larry Hale explains why the state has refused Clarence Moses L. a new trial.
They didn't give him a new trial because of precedent that was set in the Supreme Court, which states that the destruction of the evidence in and of itself does not constitute bad faith, which is virtually impossible for the defense to actually prove that there was bad faith. So they denied him a new trial on that basis.
So in other words, if the defense can't prove that the police lost the evidence on purpose or because of some animus towards Clarence Moses L., then, well, it's just too bad. He has to stay in jail.
Right. In the 2007, Ken Gordon, who passed away last year, he was a state congressperson in Colorado, actually tried to get a bill passed that would have allowed him to have a new trial. But that bill was scuttled by the DA now, Mitch Morrissey, who testified that Clarence Moses L. did not deserve a new trial. And he basically lied about the actual evidence of the case. So the state legislature tried to actually go around that so he could actually have his freedom and vindicate himself in court. But Mitch Morrissey, who was still the DA, was all along stood in the way of that actually happening, despite whatever evidence of his innocence, his Clarence Moses L. innocence.
And the Denver Post did its own investigation and found that Clarence Moses L. is by no means alone.
Correct. There was different videos that were put together by an association that works with DNA evidence. And, you know, they found at that time there was like 144 cases of people who had the evidence destroyed. And the Innocence Project actually has states on this website, there's 311 people have actually been exonerated through DNA evidence. So it means they actually had it. And if Clarence had it in this particular case, they would have exonerated him.
Clarence Moses L. was convicted on rather flimsy evidence, if one discounts the missing DNA anyway. The main witness against him identified him because of a vision that came to her in a dream.
Yes. The woman had been drinking with three people the night of the incident that happened. And when the police arrived, she stated that it was either Elsie, Earl, or Darnell, and Earl and Elsie are brothers. And she stated that later at the hospital. And she was brutally beaten. You know, she wound up losing vision in one eye. And it wasn't until a day and a half later where she said she had a dream. And her psych evaluation said that she had had premonitions before. And he said there was no evidence. Clarence was asking if they test the DNA all along, even though DNA evidence in 1987 was very new. And defense, you know, was very wary of having it tested. What was tested was the semen, and it found that the secretor of the person who attacked her had, they had an H antigen. And Clarence Moses had an H and a B antigen. And the person who actually just recently wrote a confession, Elsie Jackson, one of the original people identified, secreted H antigen. So that he's tied to the actual evidence. They did test it, not Clarence Moses. So, right, they had absolutely nothing. And Elsie Jackson was later actually convicted of a 1992 rape of a daughter, of a mother and daughter, of a nine-year-old daughter and her mother. And he's actually in prison for life for that right now.
So Clarence Moses L. has been in prison for 25 years. A state lawmaker has tried to pass a bill that would have given him a new shot at a fair trial. What do the people's assemblies want to happen next?
We want him to be free. Right now there is a motion for a hearing, and hopefully there will be a response for that soon. And that's on the basis of the new evidence, which is the confession of Elsie Jackson. But we have a petition out. And we're starting a calling campaign, and we're, you know, demanding that the DA set him free. He's actually been in 27 years because of the evidence that it cites overwhelmingly. Clarence Moses L. has actually had an opportunity to plea, and he would have been free. But he said all along, I'm not guilty. I'm not going to accept the plea and admit guilt when I've done nothing wrong. So he stood on his principles and has continued to fight. And I think it's time that he be set free, because it's any day in jail would be tortured, but 27 years in prison, you know, is cruel and unusual. And the brother's innocent.
And how can people sign that petition?
They can go to the Facebook site, which is Free Clarence Moses L., and they will find the petition as well as any other information regarding the specifics of the case on that Facebook site. Or they can go to peoplespowerassemblies.org, and they can find the case there as well, and the petition, and signed it. It will go to legislatures as well as to the DA, the Attorney General, the police chief, and the mayor, and the city council in Denver.
That was Larry Hale of the People's Power Assemblies.
The mostly black town of Benton Harbor, Michigan, sits on the shores of a great lake, a place of poverty amidst a sea of whites. Benton Harbor community leader Reverend Edward Pinckney called a press conference last week to announce a protest for March 1st against police brutality and corruption. Reverend Pinckney says black men from Benton Harbor have a habit of turning up dead in Lake Michigan.
It all started with Eric McGinnis. That was about 20 years ago when black bodies have came up missing, or for some reason unknown, they claimed that they tried to swim across the lake. So in the last 4 years, we had four bodies come floating up on Lake Michigan. And every time it ends up, no foul play. Timothy Allen Bulldog, his penis was cut off. And he always had a little braid on top of his head. That was cut off. And once again, no foul play. Toby Williams, found in the lake. They claim no foul play. What did he do, go swimming in the lake? No, sir. He was put in there. Dwayne Flowers, he was found with weights on his leg holding him down. And once again, no foul play. It goes on and on and on.
Well, clearly some foul play is going on. Who do you think is doing the foul playing?
Well, let me say this. The last person to see Eric McGinnis alive was a sheriff. And once again, they said no foul play. The last person to see Timothy Bulldog Allen alive was the St. Joseph Police Department. And they had it on video. where he was talking to them, but they didn't have anything after that, and they said no foul play. So what happened to this young man? Also, Dwayne Flowers, when they found him with his being weighted down in the lake, somebody had to put the weights on him. Somebody had to tie him down. Somebody had to do this. So what we're doing now, we're calling for a mass demonstration for March 1st to make sure we get some answers about what's happening to our kids.
How is it that Benton Harbor, which is overwhelmingly a black town, has such bad relations with its police department?
Over 90% of the people that live in Benton Harbor are African Americans. Over 90% of the people on the police department are Caucasians. So that right there is the answer in my sight. You have to have people that live in your community who cares about the people in the community to police the community. They have a job to serve and protect. They do not serve and protect the residents here in Benton Harbor. And they've been doing it for a long time. They care less. You have more police beatings here than probably even up in Detroit, and we only have 10,000 people. Nobody takes a stand. Nobody wants to get involved. If you got a job, you're definitely not going to get involved because you're afraid you're going to lose your job.
And who is the main employer in Benton Harbor?
That's Whirlpool Corporation. And what they do, less than 0.5%, the 4,000 people that's employed by Whirlpool, less than 0.5% are Benton Harbor residents. Less.
Well, what you described doesn't sound like Michigan. It sounds like Mississippi and a company town.
Most people say, well, they have beaten us down. Well, it's time that we start beating up, start changing the way we do business around here. We have to make them either put up or shut up. It's time that we fight back, show the people that we're capable. Because it's not about us. It's about the future of our children. That's where we're missing the boat at.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you'll find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. And while you're there, check out the latest episode of Black Agenda Television. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the black left. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host Nellie Bailey. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Melissa Gerson.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.